The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, we're going to get started.
Here he is.
Here he is. He gets to make an entrance. I'm Jessica Chani Dausch. I'm one of the full-time legal rhetoric instructors here at Washington College of Law. And I'm very excited to be moderating our panel, our first panel of the day, which is a panel on narrative. We have four very interesting speakers with unique, but all hopefully we're going to find a theme here to their topics. First, we're going to hear from Anne Schalick, who is immediately to my right here. She's also from Washington College of Law. She's a professor of law and a Carrington Shields Scholar. She started the Women in the Law Clinic, or in the Women in the Law program, and teaches in the Women in the Law Clinic, as well as the Public Interest Clinic and numerous other courses here at Washington College of Law. Today, she will discuss narrative practices within the lawyer-client relationship, appreciating the dynamics of storytelling. Then we'll hear from Bob Dinnerstein, also from Washington College of Law. He's professor of law and director of the New Disability Rights Law Clinic. He's, in the past here at Washington College of Law, been director of the clinical law program, as well as associate dean for academic affairs. Before coming to WCL, he practiced in the Department of Justice litigating cases concerning conditions in state mental retardation and mental illness institutions. And he's been very active in the area of disability law through a number of national committees and organizations. And today he's going to discuss the complex role of using narratives in disability cases. Then we have Professor Linda Edwards. She's from Mercer University Law School, a professor and director of the legal writing program at Mercer. She's served as the chair of the Legal Writing Institute, chair of the AALS section on legal reasoning, research, and writing, and on the board of directors of the Association of Legal Writing Directors. She's been a visiting scholar at Harvard Law School, researching jurisprudence and legal reasoning. She is the author of numerous articles and books on legal writing, including one that we use here in our first year legal rhetoric program. And today she's going to discuss the law's narrative, telling stories in legal argument. And then we have Professor Philip Meyer. He's from Vermont Law School, professor and director of the legal writing program. He's taught on law and narrative, as well as law and popular culture, among others. He's published articles on numerous topics, including narrative and law, film and law, legal writing, trial advocacy, and argumentation. He's the co-author of a book on law and popular culture, and he'll be discussing portions of his article, Vignettes from a Narrative Primer. So we'll get started with Anne. We'll also take questions at the very end for all four of our speakers, so we'll have time to do that in a moment.
Well, I'm going to continue with James Boyd White's theme about Tom Sawyer as lawyer. Rhetoric and narrative have long been seen as relevant to courts and to courtrooms. We can tell from popular culture all the time that, that courts and courtrooms make great stories, and storytelling goes on within them, and so that's part of what we know. And we've seen within legal academia various movements of critical thought take up this theme of law as storytelling. We see it in feminist theory, we see it in critical race theory, particularly strongly, but certainly in other branches of legal thought too. But I'll be talking about something a little bit different, about thinking about narrative and thinking about storytelling and its relationship within the relationship of lawyer and client. So thinking about narrative, not so much in terms of persuasion or deliberation, which are the ways that oftentimes storytelling is framed, but narrative as a process of recounting of the self, more in the genre of autobiography or memoir or some literary forms like that. So let me go to the paradigm that the clinical thought has dominated clinical thinking to a great extent of the lawyer-client relationship. Clinicians have long rejected the notion that clients should fit into the law as defined by written law, and have taken clients as people who come with problems. So that aspect of clinical thought has been embedded really from the beginning, and it's one of the ways that clinical thought pushes back against the force of law. But sometimes sometimes lawyering is thought of as fitting clients into courts and courtrooms, that a lawyer is seen as collecting facts, evidence, engaging in strategic thinking in order to win in a courtroom. And sometimes even those of who engage in clinical work accept this paradigm when we think about what happens when clients come into lawyers' offices. And a lot of our work has been on trying to push back against this notion that lawyers are just collecting facts from clients, that rather what narrative theory gives us and thinking about what happens in the lawyer-client relationship as narrative is that really pushing ourselves to think about the client not as giving facts but as giving a narrative, an account of his or her life, a narrative or an account that has meaning in his or her life, that expresses the desires that client brings with him or her, and expresses the emotions that mediate those desires. So that what we need to teach our students is to listen to what the client says, not as accumulating facts from the client, but as listening for the narratives that the client is conveying. And the client does not just come in and convey a narrative as if the client is coming into a recording booth and we are the recorders of what the client is saying, but the client is telling the story of his or her, some piece of his or her life, something that has happened, a problem that the client has, within the particular relationship with the lawyer. And so how the client looks at the lawyer, what the dynamics of race and culture and status and class and gender have to do with that relationship, all have an effect on the account that the client gives and an effect on how the lawyer listens to that account and understands it. So once we look at the lawyer-client relationship, not in the framework of just accumulating facts, thinking about evidence, being strategic, it gives us some sort of almost obvious ways of reconceiving the lawyer-client relationship. First is that, as we know about storytelling from our day-to-day lives, the story always changes. We never tell the story the same twice. And no matter what branch of narrative theory you come from, and there are many, many branches that are often in conflict with each other, but all of them have some account that stories change in the telling, and that every time you tell the story, it will be different because the teller tells it differently and starts to understand it differently. The way the hearer responds to it prompts different thoughts in the teller, and so the story will be different. Well, if lawyers understand that about how clients tell stories about what has happened in their lives, then they will not so be so ready to think about, oh, my client lied to me. My client did not tell me this critical fact. My client shaded the truth in a particular way. If we begin from a notion of what we know about storytelling in so much of the world, we can hear and understand and interpret and confront these changes in different ways. So that's the first obvious thought about the lawyer-client relationship that comes from thinking about it as a site of narrative telling and narrative hearing. The second has to do with client desire. The clients come to lawyers with problems, and sometimes they have a clear sense of what they want to happen, what desires are compelling them to come to the lawyer. And sometimes they don't. Sometimes they have a bunch of ambivalent desires, or in going to a lawyer, the possibilities of what they could have or achieve are changed in certain ways depending upon what the legal rules are out there that are operating. And so the notion that you say to your client, well, what is it you want? What is your goal here? Is, from the perspective of narrative, a very complex, changing question that the client desires oftentimes will get framed and reframed, change, expand, contract, depending upon how the story, how she or he tells the story over and over again, how the lawyer hears the story over and over again, and how the lawyer then imagines and talks about the law to the client. So James Boyd White's stories about how a lawyer, in talking about the law, should be confused, should have moments of not knowing what the law says to this client's particular story, should struggle with those moments of confusion, is something that's important to communicate to our students in terms of what it is to be a good lawyer. The good lawyer is not the lawyer with the ready, pat answer, but the good lawyer is the one who struggles with what it means to take the shifting client desires and turn them into a legal action that is going to be meaningful and important in the client's life. The third obvious thing is that in this dialogue between lawyer and client, we hope that the client will come to see new possibilities. That one of the reasons clients come to lawyers is not because they know what all of their choices are, but they want to find them out. And it's not just that the lawyer knows what all those choices are and will tell them to the client, but if the lawyer listens to what the client wants, then in that listening can hear the different desires and can start to develop different possibilities for clients, different ways that the story can be told as a result of the legal action that the lawyer and client will take together. The fourth obvious point is that the story develops within the relationship, so that students should not be, and lawyers should not be surprised that the story changes as the relationship develops. So as the client comes to trust the lawyer, as the lawyer hears the client's story respectfully, which does not mean that the lawyer accepts everything that the client says, those are two different concepts, but that as the lawyer hears it with respect, and sometimes respect can mean challenging, that the client's story will change, that is a given, not an aberration. What narrative also gives us as lawyers is some practices, some different kinds of practices and different ways of thinking about practices that we can engage in as lawyers, that we can teach our students to engage in, that will make them better. So if we think about storytelling as having a kind of standard trajectory, and I suspect that some of my panelists will talk about this some more, so I won't do it in detail, that there's a setting to the story, that the story begins, the plot of the story begins with something that narrative theorists call a steady state, a way the world is. That then there is some trouble. Mostly clients would not be coming to lawyers if they were just in a steady state. They usually come because there's some present trouble or they're anticipating a future trouble. And they're seeking some change in that trouble, some redress for it, to go back to the way things were or to change how things were. And oftentimes clients come feeling some moral imperatives about the story, that there are themes to it that matter to them. There are lessons that they want to teach, to give, prove to themselves or to teach to others. There are morals to those stories that they tell. And there are characters in the story that matter. Who the people are in the story, why they're there. Why they appear and what roles they come as very developed human beings or as very cardboard people. So with these narratives, when we think about the lawyer-client relationship, if the lawyer then can help the client and use those aspects of stories to find out more about what the client is saying to us in the story. Does the client like that steady state? What is it like? What is the basic frame of the client's life? Does it work or not? Why is there the trouble? Who's causing the trouble? Who does the trouble have meaning to? What is it that, what ways does the client want us as the lawyer to intervene in that trouble? Do we think we can intervene in that way? Are we comfortable in intervening in the story in that way? So these categories of storytelling are relevant not only to how we think about presenting stories to other people in the outside world to persuade them, but are also categories that help lawyers think about how to understand what their client is telling them, what their client wants, what they're hearing, and what roles they, as lawyers, can play in the development of those stories before we even get to the outside world and how others hear those stories.
Write down my time. Always fun to both be on a panel with Anne and dangerous to follow her. Sets a high standard. James Boyd White this morning made reference to Mark Twain, to Plato, to Homer, real iconic, Emily Dickinson, iconic figures. The paper on which I'm basing this talk and which I gave a talk about before, the real title of it is Every Picture Tells a Story, Don't It? The Complex Role of Narrative in Disability Cases. Those of you in my era would possibly recognize that as the name of a Rod Stewart song. This is before Rod Stewart decided that old standards was where his future lay and not singing rock and roll. So we've kind of come down a little bit, I hope, not just completely on the issue of which music we or which authors we refer to. The issue of narrative and particularly with respect to people with disabilities, I think, is every bit as complicated as Anne says, and perhaps more so. And I think the reason it's more so is because of characteristics of people with disabilities, and here I'm particularly thinking about people with mental disabilities, but also because of society's understandings, evolving as those may be, about people with disabilities. That is, to some extent, some of the things that we would think of as just straightforward issues, however complicated we could make them, become not straightforward or are seen as not straightforward because we're dealing with difference, because we're dealing with people who seem not to be following the same set of implicit rules that we accept from everybody else. And that creates a problem. It creates a problem because not only is there not a pure narrative that doesn't change, but there are multiple narratives that exist outside that lawyer-client relationship that people come to that relationship with, even if they are highly motivated to question them, to challenge them, to reconfigure them. And even if you can, within the relationship, change that, you have the very real problem of how do you present to the court, to the outside world, a narrative that doesn't follow that route. So there's a lot of narratives one can talk about with respect to disability and people with intellectual disabilities or mental disabilities. Probably the one that is most powerful, because it doesn't necessarily seem to be one that initially seems to be a bad one, is the one of paternalism or protection toward people with disabilities. That is, we must make sure that people with disabilities are not harmed, are not abused, are not neglected, and therefore we should represent them, if we're lawyers, in ways that make sure that that is the high value. Historically, there's very good reason to be concerned about the abuse and neglect of people with disabilities, and I'd be the last one to say that's irrelevant as a matter of context. But the answer to the problem of neglect and abuse is not necessarily simply, let's put the person in a safe situation where nothing could ever happen to them, and consequently there'd be no abuse. A, I'm not sure we could ever do that. But B, we don't live our own lives that way. And we should ask ourselves some really close questions about whether that's the best way for people with disabilities to live. Now, we would not question this issue, I would suggest, in a sort of typical lawyer-client interaction. If a client says, I want to move from this institution to a group home in the community, I know it's on a busy street, I know there's a risk that I'll cross the street and I might get hurt, but I think there's some advantages to doing that. And if we could imagine that kind of situation, perhaps with someone who is older but not otherwise cognitively impaired, we might say, well, sure, that's your choice, and let's see if we can make that happen. Well, something in the nature of an Alice in Wonderland type of experience happens sometimes when you're dealing with people with disabilities, because the lawyer will listen to that same story and say, I don't know if that's such a good idea. You could get hurt there. You could be harmed there. It could be too risky. Maybe it's better for you to stay in the institution. And something which we would say, well, gee, where do you get off, the lawyer, as making that judgment? You're representing a client and who ought to be able to guide you as to what he or she wants. Well, I know, but this client is limited, and maybe the client really doesn't understand what I understand about what a big bad world is out there. And so I better reassure this client about risk. And the problem with that is that we are very much inclined toward, I would say, a risk-averse view of life, one that we feel very bad if something happened to somebody who was dependent or deemed to be dependent. We would feel very bad if we felt we contributed to that. And that's what one hears if you talk to lawyers who represent people with intellectual disabilities or mental disabilities. You hear this all the time. Last week, I was involved in a training session we had for lawyers who handle cases in the District of Columbia on behalf of people with intellectual disabilities, where the issue is, do they have the capacity to consent to receive services, or must they be committed because they don't have that capacity? And in the District of Columbia, there is no longer any large institution, but there are group homes and intermediate care facilities for people with mental retardation, some of which are perhaps smaller institutions, if you want to think of it that way. So it's an issue there. And I was giving, as I do, my pitch for a client-centered approach to representing clients, including clients with disabilities, an approach that says we take seriously what the client says and we try to effectuate what the client wants, so long as it's within the law. And one of the lawyers raised his hand and said, but how can we do it if it's so obviously wrong? I said, well, tell me more about this. Well, I had a client who was living in a facility and wanted to live with his parents, and his parents absolutely told me they did not want him living with them. How can I possibly advocate such an awful thing? I said, well, let's step back for a second. What happens God forbid, if you go into the court and say, my client wishes to live with his parents. Well, I don't think the court would ever put him with his parents if the parents don't want him. Okay, so one thing we've just learned is that your worry that somehow you are such a good advocate that you would get the world to do something that otherwise does not make sense may be wrong. Maybe your self-concept as a lawyer here and dealing with the client is that you see before you is not, I can't ever take my own risk of being wrong. There's a value, a virtue, in representing this client's position, which could be deemed as the presenting one narrative that the client might have. My narrative is, I would like to return home, which is where lots of people live, and be with my family, which is what lots of people want, and I'd rather not live in this other place. Now, as Anne said, deferring to a client, being client-centered, doesn't mean that as soon as the client says, I want to live with my parents, I say, okay, let's go, knowing that the parents perhaps have told me otherwise. But I can engage the client in a conversation about that and say, well, have you talked to your parents about this? Yes. What have they said? Well, they don't want me to do this. Okay, so let's see whether or not there's a way, can we change their view? Is there some other possibility? Do you need to rethink your thought of that? This comes back to this issue of the interaction between lawyer and client, which is so critical to the understanding of how one presents one's narrative. Now, there are a lot of issues one could talk about with respect to the lawyer-client perceptions and in particular with respect to the narratives that come into play. But in addition to the lawyer serving as, if you will, a mediating entity between client and the legal world and the world out there, there are all these other people out there. They've got titles like doctor, like special education coordinator, like psychologist one, like psychologist two, like social worker three. We don't even know what they mean. But we do know this. They purport to speak for others. So if I have a disability and I want to talk to somebody, it's not so easy for me to do it. I have to kind of go through people. I have to persuade the professionals that it's okay. I won't be embarrassing. I can talk. I can do these things. And a lot of the professionals are very jealous of their turf, and I include lawyers in that. And so the person has to overcome this first step. I demand to be heard, something which we would say is quite understandable and quite accepted for people who don't have disabilities, but we question it with people. Well, maybe you'll say the wrong thing. Well, I don't know how they're going to respond to you. Well, you know, people, they're a little uncomfortable around you. Well, deal with it, we might say. And we might say, let's try to maximize your effect. And I have to say that this is one area, when you've been doing this work as long as I have, there are many disadvantages to that. But there are some advantages, and one advantage is you do see gradually in glacial time, pre-global warming, that change does begin to happen. So I was at a hearing this past week before the D.C. City Council regarding a possible change in the D.C. statute that regulates the commitment of people with mental retardation that I was describing earlier, and several of the panels had people with intellectual disabilities themselves testifying directly about their experience of having been in the institution and about what they wanted in the community. Very powerful. It's very hard for a political official to ignore one of his or her constituents that's speaking from personal experience. Now, we have to take into account some of the ways in which, particularly for people with intellectual disabilities, their limitations make it harder for them to do what perhaps would be easier for you and I to do, although I say perhaps because I'm not so sure it would be easier. So one of the things that was unseen, but which I knew existed, was an advocate, a friend, somebody who had some professional experience, had sat down with the individual to help that person write the testimony, to think about how to present it in the 3 minutes that the council provided, so that you didn't just assume, gee, autonomy means let the person go and just kind of speak, and then we'll step back, and then we'll say, isn't that nice? You know, look how well they're doing. That wouldn't be effective advocacy for someone in another situation. Why should we think it would be effective here? So there is the notion that a true conversation, a true effort to get at, let's say, a better narrative, requires a kind of respect, a giving of dignity to the other individual, as if you had it to give, but a recognition of their dignity, and a recognition of a kind of situated autonomy that says they have the right to say what they want to say, and we should help them as allies, as friends, to get them to say that. But we are very much running or looking uphill at a variety of things. I just want to identify some of those things. One is, while there are some settings in which there's greater recognition of the role that people with disabilities can play in society, we still have a lot of things to overcome. One of the things we have to overcome is the limitations of language. The people that I mentioned who testified at this hearing, one of their major points, and it's a point you hear it every time when it's talking about people who have the condition that has been called mental retardation, is they hate the term. They watch the TV shows you do. They hear the use of retard as an epithet. They hear it on the playground. They don't want to hear it anymore. They don't accept it. They want a new term. Well, what new term? And it's the field has had extraordinary difficulties in coming up with a term that will capture the condition that we have called this one thing, but that will not either be over or under inclusive. And I won't get into the details of the debate, just to say it's always an issue, and frankly, every time you come up with something, some significant number of people say, I don't like that one. You know, we need something else. And so that's a big problem. If we don't have language to describe in a consistent way a set of circumstances, it becomes harder than to talk about what to do. We also have from the ridiculous to the sublime. It's very hard to get newspapers and magazines to use what we would call people-first language for people with disabilities. Say, person with disability, you know, admitted into American university. Because person with disability takes up a lot of space in the headline. They'd rather say, the disabled and admitted to American university. And somebody with disabilities reads that and says, I'm not part of this big lump of people called the disabled. I want to be known as an individual. I want to have my individuality stressed, but I'm running up against the limitations of the headline. Well, that seems like a bad reason to not give full effect to some more respectful language, but it's out there. And then we get our friends in the courts who seem to be time and time again unable to get past certain kind of constructs. So I just want to read you from a 1982 Supreme Court decision, Youngberg versus Romeo, a very well-known decision in the field, for just a brief description of the main plaintiff in that case, Nicholas Romeo. Respondent Nicholas Romeo is profoundly retarded. Although 33 years old, he has the mental capacity of an 18-month-old child with an IQ between 8 and 10. I guess the court was not willing to go with 9. He cannot talk and lacks the most basic self-care skills. This makes him sound barely human. The court went on to say, whatever else is happening to Nicholas Romeo, and there was a lot of abuse going on in that institution, the one thing we know is there's no way he can ever live outside of this institution. We are talking about somebody needing lifelong care. And in the paper, I talk about how the court is actually wrong about that assumption. Not only was it wrong about the legal argument, it was wrong as a matter of fact, because 2 years later, Nicholas Romeo, IQ of 8 to 10 and all, was living in a community-based program. And the institution in which he was living, the Pennhurst State School and Hospital in Philadelphia, is closed, and no one's living there anymore. That description, that use of this term mental age, which the psychologists love, and which means nothing, a mental age of 3 doesn't mean a 3-year-old crawling around, it has some much more profound kind of meaning, is very difficult to get away from. And people fall into it, and they sometimes fall into it because a whole other aspect of narrative that we know, of course, is that narrative in litigation is instrumental narrative. It's narrative for a purpose. It's trying to achieve something. If you're a prosecutor prosecuting somebody on a hate crime basis, who has taken advantage of an individual, a woman with mental retardation or intellectual disability, you want to make her to be as childlike, as unable to consent to any kind of actual consensual interaction as you can. So you're up there saying, as happened in the famous Glenridge, New Jersey case, written about in the newspapers and the books, here is this person, look how defenseless, look how utterly childlike she was, and these young boys took advantage of her. They did take advantage of her. It was an awful crime. They sodomized her. It should have been prosecuted. Did it have to be prosecuted in a way that made this 18-year-old woman into somebody that looked like a 2-year-old girl? I'd say no. But getting prosecutors to not want to push for convictions, very hard to do. Getting courts to not define people in terms of mental age, very hard to do. So the conclusion I would have is this. The narratives that are floating around in the law office are there, and they're also coming in with all the baggage that both you as lawyer and client comes in with, and that's one thing. And even if you get past that, you have to figure out how to mediate from that situation to the various forums, whether it's court hearings or legislative hearings, in which people with disabilities are represented. Knowing that in the world out there of popular culture and other culture, we're not there yet by any means. It just, I think, suggests the high level of challenge, the steep hill that we have, but with luck and with continued work, maybe it'll get a little bit less steep over time. Thanks.
Well, I'm going to make the instrumental shift and talk about the ways that narrative has a role to play in legal argument, and by that I mean the ways we talk about the law, about the authorities, about cases, about statutes and policies and such. I think we would this morning all start from the premise that narrative is a primary way, and perhaps the primary way, that we understand the world. That whether we're aware of it or not, narrative is foundational to all of the linear, more abstract forms of reasoning that we use. When we're presented with a situation, unconsciously perhaps, we immediately construct a narrative about that situation, and from that narrative platform, we then construct our rules or our policies or our principles, and perhaps all we talk about after that are the rules and the policies and the principles. But they've nonetheless had this narrative foundation. Now, if that's true, then certainly narrative is a powerful tool of advocacy. In public legal discourse, in the brief, that is, we tend to think of narrative as playing a role primarily in the fact statement and in the argument portion of the brief where we're talking about how the law applies to the facts. And we're talking there, of course, about the story, the narrative of the client. But does narrative have a role to play in the part of the argument section where we're talking about the governing law, about what the rule of law is, the principle that is going to apply in this particular situation? Well, it comes no surprise to you that I think the answer may be yes. And so let's see if we can explore that a little bit this morning. And we will mention a couple of the characteristics of narrative. Anne said that somebody would probably do that. But I'm not going to say too much about it because I think we all already understand these basic principles, and that is primarily characters and plot. To have a story, we have to have characters and a plot. Now, characters often are human beings, but they do not have to be human beings. They can be human-like. So, for instance, they can be courts, they can be legislatures, but they can even also be a case precedent or a statute, or even more abstractly, they can be a legal principle, a doctrine, perhaps a constitutional doctrine. This afternoon's panel on narrative will tell, or on metaphor, will tell us a little bit more about how that happens. But because our minds work metaphorically, we're prepared actually to think about these things as if they were people, as if they were characters in a story. And that, as it turns out, serves us rather well when we're trying to use narrative in legal argument. We also have to have a plot. Something important has to be in the process of happening, something with some kind of tension that needs resolution, usually, as Anne alluded to, a legitimate state and a steady state that has now had the introduction of some kind of trouble, and we need to resolve it. That is not always the plot, but it is probably the most common plot. So the struggle between those two things actually sets up most of the time, the narrative tension that we then have to resolve. Okay, so it's easy to see how this works with a client story, and we've all done that. We've written the client story. We have a protagonist. Often that's the client, though not always. We'll have an antagonist that may be the other side in the litigation, or it may be somebody else in the litigation, and there'll be some supporting characters. No problem. We know how to do that. But what about if we're talking about the law? In the argument section where we start actually saying what is the governing rule of law here, well, who are the characters there? So we're going to actually use a couple of briefs this morning to help us explore that. Bowers versus Hardwick and Miranda versus Arizona. So we know that in Miranda, we had a situation where Mr. Miranda was arrested and interrogated prior to arraignment, and he did not have a lawyer. And at that time, there was no Supreme Court opinion requiring the presence of a lawyer prior to arraignment. In Bowers versus Hardwick, we had Mr. Hardwick, who was peacefully in the privacy of his own home in his own bedroom when the police break in without a warrant, and he's arrested for the crime of sodomy. So we know the story of what happened there. So those stories get told in the fact statement of that brief. But then we turn to the discussion of the law. Now, I'm going to say that I think there are at least two basic classic narratives about the law, and these briefs help us explore them. They are the narrative of rescue and the narrative of birth. Classic narratives, they both posit, and I'm going to talk a little bit of archetype here now, anticipating again this afternoon, they both posit a character, or an archetypal character, that I think I'll call the magic child, or it's some other pure and innocent entity. And often, usually, it's the principle involved. It's the policy. It's the constitutional doctrine or right that is in jeopardy here. The archetypal quality of this doctrine is that the magic child is defenseless, vulnerable, young, but has some kind of transformative power that is important for all of us. We have to have the magic child functioning well and in a healthy way in order for us to be who we are. And then we're going to have a protagonist. And in, I think, the argument section, the protagonist usually is the court we're writing to. Protagonist being the champion, the person who is actually engaged in this hard task, the person who has to resolve the dramatic crisis that the plot has given. So the actual story of the law really becomes a story about how the court is going to resolve this situation, resolve the trouble that has interfered with the steady state. And interestingly, I think, the story that we write in legal argument does not, we do not resolve the dramatic tension. We bring the dramatic tension at its height to the feet of the court, inviting the court to resolve the tension. And the way we have presented the story up until that time is going to significantly impact how the court chooses to resolve that dramatic tension. So let's see how these two things play out in Bowers and in Miranda. We'll take Bowers first. So who are the characters in Bowers? Well, the magic child, or the pure innocent character, is the right to privacy in our human, intimate human relationships and in our home. The protagonist, the champion, is the United States Supreme Court. The antagonist, who would that be? If you read the brief, it's really very clear. The antagonist is the state of Georgia, my home state, I would say. And I think that was another strategic choice of storytelling that the brief writer made, because the state of Georgia, I have to confess, has a flawed reputation. Particularly in front of the Supreme Court, and particularly at this time, had a flawed reputation. So if you read the legal argument section in the brief, it's every other paragraph, it seems, the state of Georgia is capitalized. It's the state of Georgia did this, and the state of Georgia did that. Very clearly, the state of Georgia is the antagonist here. The brief presents the narrative action or tension. I'll just read you a little bit. The state of Georgia thus wholly ignores this court's long tradition of sensitivity to government intrusions into intimacy and the home. and I'll stop there. But that's very early on in the legal argument, and in that one sentence, we get all three of these characters. We get the state of Georgia wholly ignores this court's long tradition of sensitivity. This is the sort of championness of the court here to governmental intrusions into intimacy and the home. The magic child or the magic vulnerable but critically important principle that we're talking about here. So the brief goes on presenting the court as having essentially created the right to privacy and being the only entity that can now protect it from this onslaught. Okay, let's look at Miranda versus Arizona. Prior to Miranda, as you probably know, there was a right to counsel after arraignment, but not before. So you could have an arrest and a pre-arraignment interrogation without a lawyer, and then once that interrogation was over, the arraignment could occur, but the damage had been largely done at that point. And I think this is a sort of an unusual narrative, a little less often used, a birth narrative, because here the brief had to present the right to counsel post-arrest but pre-arraignment as not being fully developed yet there. So this had to be a story about the right to counsel having been begun and been developed step by step, case by case, over several hundred years, frankly, because the brief mentions starts in England, actually. And it's almost as if we are having a story here about the development of a fetus, about the building of something beautiful, some kind of creation and development story. And the brief takes us through each one of those stages, and we find that there's only one more step to take. The only part of this doctrine that has not yet been created and developed is this one little space of time in between arrest and arraignment. This is the last step to take. And so the brief presents this doctrine to the court, the only character who's able to fully create that doctrine, and the narrative force of the story of the development of that right is a forceful part of the brief's urging of the court to take that last step. We all want to finish an important project like that, the creation of something beautiful. And the court is asked to take that last step. And in fact, as we know, that's exactly what they did. So since it's true that we understand the whole world as narrative, including the way the law came to be what it is and the way it should become something else, then we shouldn't be afraid to tell the story of the law in legal narratives so that these opinions and statutes and precedents and policies can all become characters driving the narrative plot to where we hope the law will be when we finish.
I'm going to try to cut down the space a little bit. Seems I know so many of you folks, and to speak from there to here would be somewhat surreal. Especially
you're just trying to get away from the minute notices that Jessica
keeps
getting.
Yeah, I'm going to catch
you anyways. Yeah, I'm going to present some vignettes from an article called Vignettes from a Narrative Primer. And the audience for this for the vignettes, not the article but the book, is an audience of post-conviction relief practitioners in death penalty cases. And what the project is trying to do is to systematically introduce a vocabulary that might provide some flesh on the bones of what it means to tell a good story That is, some of the stuff, like Linda was talking, for example, about Miranda, a case that I'm somewhat familiar with. And some of the power of Miranda comes from the simple fact that the person who wrote the brief made the intelligent choice to use a limited third-person perspective and actually go with Miranda down the steps into the room. And that creates a power that usually you don't see in briefs, because most briefs use the default position of using an omniscient third-person perspective rather than that limited perspective. That's also the power in a brief like Riggins, for example, where you sit in the jury box and you watch Mr. Riggins, who's been heavily medicated, and he is described as acting like a zombie. And the power of that narrative in the statement of the case derives from the perspective that's chosen. But one thing that we don't do in legal writing is we don't really teach people the narrative skills that they need to know. We talk about storytelling, but we don't really put flesh on the bones. I think folks like Bob Dinnerstein and Ann Schalick do that in the clinic. There's a reason for this, but before I get to the reason, let me step back a bit. Jerome Bruner says, the psychologist, says that there are two fundamental modes of thought. There's the narrative mode and the paradigmatic / analytic mode. And these two modalities are discrete. They're fundamentally irreducible. It was interesting to me that Dean Grossman was, when he was giving his introductory remarks, he talked about litigation and getting stories that will stick in torture cases to persuade a jury. And what he was talking about was the power of narrative and how intrinsically legal arguments must be wedded to effective storytelling. We don't do, I don't think, that work particularly well in law school. Law school focuses upon paradigmatic reasoning. If you look in the New York Times, actually, from Wednesday, I was reading it on the plane, that they talk about the Carnegie study. And the Carnegie study says that law schools do a good job teaching legal positivism and legal analysis, but they don't deal with the other 80% of what it means to be a good lawyer. What they're teaching fundamentally is trying to help people pass the bar. That's fine, but it leaves alone what lawyers really need to know. And one of the things they need to know is effective narrative persuasion. Okay? And that brings me to the primer. Again, this is written for post-conviction relief practitioners, young federal public defenders, to teach them narrative skills. And the reason we have to do this is because they didn't get it in law school. And matter of fact, law school worked to the detriment of effective storytelling by creating these rigid systems of analytical reasoning that prevent them from doing the type of writing and making the intelligent choices that they absolutely need to do to persuade an audience. And it's not just making a closing argument to a jury, it's in writing the brief. You know, and in post-conviction relief practice, it's really crucial because you never get to make the argument unless you can persuade the judge in the brief. And the only way you persuade the judge in the brief is by telling one hell of a compelling story. But if you don't know about plot, if you don't know about how to construct a character, if you don't know about the choices and perspectives that you might have, if you don't know how to make an effective setting, for example, in Miranda, that will be reflected in the opinion of the court, but show what it's like to go downstairs into an interrogation room and be questioned. If you can't isolate those discrete aspects of narrative and incorporate them into your brief, you're at more of a disadvantage. Also, you won't be able to effectively critique the storytelling that's certainly going on in the prosecutor's brief. Okay? So let me give you just a, and you have to tell me at the time, because I'll be really, you know, over the time unless you stop me. Because actually, this is a subject that I'm really passionate about.
Oh, no.
Couldn't guess. And I drink a lot of coffee, too. But the primer is divided in, it's a legal writing text, but it doesn't look like other legal writing texts. It's divided into lessons rather than chapters. The chapters cover subjects like plotting, and Ann Schalick used the Amsterdam Brunner definition of basic plotting, but it goes far beyond that. Character, casting, and scene. Narrative time. Where do you begin your story? Where do you end it? There's a whole range of choices in that. Do you move it through time chronologically? We teach our students, use the past tense. Actually, the present tense has a lot more life in it than the past tense, and it's much more engaging. There's no reason why you can't do that. We say move chronologically. Well, no, don't move chronologically. That, you can use flash forwards. You can use flashbacks. You can start any place in the story. You can start way back in time, the time of the crime. You can start, for example, you can start in the judicial proceedings. You want to bury the crime. You can start in the actual judicial proceedings. So you have to know about narrative time. You have to know about settings and environments. Very briefly, I'm going to give you some slivers or excerpts from this article, and it should be in your box this week from the Journal of Legal whatever. I'm not being facetious. Yeah, I got narrative there. But showing rather than telling, using quotes and transcripts, perspective or point of view and voice. I'll probably get time to go through one or two of them, and I'll read a little bit from the story, from the article, and also give you a quote. The first one is showing and telling. One of the crucial things in narrative and storytelling is rhythm. Rhythm means a lot of things, and we talk about it in terms of how the rhythm of the sentences is. But in narrative theory, the primary reference to rhythm is the alternation between scene and summary. If you read most briefs, they are deadly because they overuse summary to the exclusions of scenes. That is, quote, overuse of authorial summary is not only deadening, it may also be unreadable. Many briefs, however, despite the best intentions of the writer, are often difficult to read because the writer fails to know what to put in and what to leave out, and how and when to use showing instead of telling. Nevertheless, summary has its purposes, and these functions can be made explicit. It can, for example, accelerate the tempo of a narrative, hurrying us through the events which would be uninteresting or too interesting if lingered over. So sometimes, for example, a horrific crime in the Michael Williams case, which is a brief I've looked at in a different article, not only does the attorney use passives, so you don't know who the trigger person is in that case, but it's also buried in summary rather than through a scene. Here is a vivid example of a scene from Executioner's Song by Norman Mailer. It's a prosecutorial depiction of a crime. There's a great deal of narrative intelligence at work in selecting particular details so that you can, for example, see the blood on the tiles of the bathroom. And the way it uses an omniscient narrative perspective outside, but yet briefly dips into the mind of the victim to comment on the misplaced meaning of a smile. But it's a scene, not a summary. Here it is. Gary walked around the corner from where the truck was parked and went into a Sinclair service station. It was now deserted. There was only one man present, the attendant. He was a pleasant-looking, serious young man with broad jaws and broad shoulders. He had a clean, straight part in his hair. His jawbones were slightly farther apart than his ears. On the chest of his overalls was pinned a nameplate, Max Jensen. He asked, "Can I help you?" Gilmore brought out the .22 Browning automatic and told Jensen to empty his pockets. So soon as Gilmore had pocketed the cash, he picked up the coin changer in his free hand and said, "Go to the bathroom." Right after they passed through the bathroom door, Gilmore said, "Get down. The floor was clean. Jensen must have cleaned it in the last 15 minutes. He was trying to smile as he lay down on the floor. Gilmore said, "Put your arms under your body." Jensen got into position with his hands under his stomach. He was still trying to smile. It was a bathroom with green tiles that came to the height of your chest and tan-painted walls. The floor, 6 feet by 8 feet, was laid in dull gray tiles. A rack for paper towels on the wall had Towel Saver printed on it. The toilet had a split seat. An overhead light was in the wall. Gilmore brought the automatic to Jensen's head. "This one is for me," he said, and fired. "This one is for Nicole," he said, and fired again. The body reacted each time. He stood up. There was a lot of blood. It spread across the floor at a surprising rate. Some of it got onto the bottom of his pants. He walked out of the restroom with the bills in his pocket and the coin changer in his hand, walked by the big Coke machine and the phone on the wall, walked out of this real clean gas station. That's a scene. I think if you could reconstruct that scene, believe it or not, from a defense perspective at the Narrative Persuasion Institute. Some folks were actually saying how they would do that story. Okay. They were saying how they would do that story. It's also a product of specific narrative choices. And you can deconstruct it if you can think of it in terms of the components of the narrative. I just have 5 minutes, so let me give one last illustration. How many minutes? 1 minute?
Two or one.
Okay. Well, skip the rest of the illustrations. What am I going to do? The other things are showing versus telling. I did showing versus telling. The other is using quotes, transcripts, and testimony. A lot of briefs are putting together quotes, transcripts, and testimony. It's a bricolage work. It is stealing from other people and putting it together into narratives rather than using your own voice. It's creative stealing and re-editing. Third one I was going to talk about, perspective. We don't really teach our students the importance of different perspectives, of what the advantages are of an omniscient voice versus a third person limited, third person essayist, first person voices. All are used in good briefs, but we don't make that differentiation and tell them what the advantages and disadvantages are of using each type of perspective. And there's a literature as to why one is good and what it is good for and what the advantages and disadvantages are. Last comment, I was going to talk about voice. This is good because I had a long, wonderful quote from Jesus' Son by Dennis Johnson and speak about the oral markings of the language and how powerful that is. But since I'm at the end of my time, I can't do it. I can only think of the line from Bob Dylan when I was driving here thinking about being the last speaker on the panel, and it was the Basement Tapes with a band. And the voice is so powerful, even though you don't know what it means, but it has relevance for this precise situation. And it was, what was it? I looked at my watch. I looked at my wrist. I punched myself in my face with my fist. Took all my potatoes down to get mashed. But but I'm still going to make it to the million-dollar bash. Ooh-wee, baby, ooh-wee, ooh-wee, baby, ooh-wee. We're all going to be there at that million-dollar bash. Now, I don't know what that means, but that's a terribly powerful voice. And you see voices all the time. There's something, I won't go into the theory as to why orality brings us back to something that's fun, what James Boyd White was talking about, that's fundamentally human between us. And you can read, last comment, you can read some of these briefs, and you can actually differentiate between a Tony Amsterdam voice and a John Bloom voice and a Mark Olive voice and a David Brock voice. They all have unique voices, and something in the power of that voice that makes those briefs particularly compelling. So take a look at this stuff, see if it's relevant to you, and it's a place where we need to go and get out from the shadow of the doctrinal curriculum. And if we don't make that move, I think it's a real disservice to our students, and it's also a hell of a lot of fun to teach. Thank you.
Well, first I want to thank all my speakers for really interesting comments, and I know there's got to be questions out there. Fortunately, we come up against lunch, so we can cheat a little bit and go a few minutes into that. So, in fact, I'll steal that microphone, and I'm just going to get up and make sure you actually do get microphones so we can all hear the questions for our speakers.
Uh-oh, I knew it. I mentioned archetype.
Well,
I'm in trouble now.
I don't know if this is on, but okay. I want to actually have a three-hour conversation with you because you're sort of blowing everything I do, which is the storytelling is client-centered, you know, per my clinical training. And so I have all these questions about how do you remain client-centered and yet shift the protagonist in the legal argument? And I wonder if, because you're looking at examples of appellate briefs where there's a very big difference in the limitations of the language and the limitations of what a judge can do, as opposed to if I'm looking at going before the judge at a trial level where the protagonist is the client and remains the client throughout the legal argument as well as the statement of the case or the presentation of the facts. So I guess that's sort of where I'm coming from is, or do you see the difference in appellate and impact litigation versus more client-centered at the trial levels?
I'm not
sure. That's my initial question for you. Do you want to keep the microphone for a minute?
I'm not sure I see why we can't have both stories happening. It seems to me that that is that nothing in telling the client's story well in the fact statement and in the application portion of the brief is at all inconsistent with also telling the story of the law that's now going to impact that. So I would certainly not want, I would want the client's story to be powerfully told in all the ways that we often think about that. But in addition, then, it's almost as if there is a sort of an over story maybe where this microcosm has happened and we're placing it in this larger context of the development of the law. And what causes the narrative, the crisis point, is the intersection there. So I don't think I see them as incompatible at all.
I think I'm just struggling with, we don't have that much time in a lawsuit to tell this part of the story, which is really only a small part of a much bigger story, whether it's the bigger story of the client's life or the bigger story of the law's life. And if there can only, I say there can only be one hero, otherwise everybody gets to recast the role and your client doesn't get to be flawed. The only person who gets to be flawed is the central figure. Mm-hmm. So if the central figure is shifting, does that mean you're doing your client a disservice? I think that's it. It's something I'm struggling with. It's not that I'm challenging. I'm actually sort of trying to understand some of my own stuff. And there's a slide where I'll have language that's saying, I don't understand.
All I can say is I've read these briefs. Granted, they were in front of the United States Supreme Court. So you're exactly right. There is a very different rhetorical setting there. But I've read these briefs, and they tell powerful client stories in the fact statement. And there is nothing in the legal argument section that detracts from that. As a matter of fact, it then incorporates the two stories together. So take a look at them and see if you think that there has been some loss. I don't know, yeah.
I don't know, is this actually making any difference? Because I can't tell if it is or not. When we were speaking this morning about where change can come from, which is one of my central preoccupations because it's something I don't understand, one of the things that was happening was that James Boyd White was saying something about, well, what I want to get to is this. It's possible that change, because what you're speaking about is very seminal briefs that have caused significant changes. That when plural voices, which is one of my personal obsessions, are allowed to enter the arena, that's when we can confront change. As long as we have one dominant voice, then we can't have change because everything is framed in a way that we already understand. And so that when you have the intersection between, for example, the client story and what you're speaking about, the story of the law, and they intersect in a new way because there are plural voices, then we can have change. And so I think that what you're saying is very interesting.
Hey, I've got a mic. So this was something that occurred to me, and then Ruth Ann's question sort of made me think that it was related to Ruth Ann's question. It occurred to me when everybody was speaking, and especially when Linda started talking about the appellate brief where the court was the protagonist, and then when Phil was so excited about narrative and having our students learn narrative, it occurred to me that what's missing in the first year of law school is people. And maybe the reason that we don't, and that's because we're reading appellate opinions in all those doctrinal classes, and that in legal writing classes, for the most part, and I know some schools do this differently, for the most part, you've got a canned memo, you don't have a real client, nobody comes in, and you don't do actual fact investigation. You do an appellate brief, not a trial court brief. And so maybe this all fits together, at least in my mind, in the sense that maybe one of the ways we can get narrative into legal writing, and I know the clinical people, you've got clients. Legal writing, we don't really have clients, and maybe that's part of the way that we can get more narrative into legal writing is to have clients to work on. Phil, take it away.
Yeah, and some folks are actually doing that. Michael Milliman at Maryland is doing that, and it's very interesting. You're right. What I think the first year does to some degree is tip the legal world upside down. So because it's purposeful. I teach criminal law. And the students at some point are really fascinated and interested, and they want to talk about motivation of characters and who are these people really and what's going on. Why did she do that? Why did she stab the guy when all she had to do was leave the house? But what I'm trying to emphasize is the doctrinal law, and I don't want them to get lost completely in the swimming facts, and I don't want them certainly to destabilize the world by seeing that not only aren't the facts fixed, but they're completely diffuse and impossible to ever know. You know, that would be a frightening premise to introduce into a doctrinal course, and so the facts and the narratives are repressed in the first year, and that's unfortunately the way students begin to conceptualize legal analysis, and it carries through to the second year and the third year, which is bad enough because they're worried about the bar exam. But what Linda and I have found is it carries into practice where the creativity that the students should have and their intuitive sense of what stories are about have been so suppressed that they're thinking in the silly categorical way that prevents them from seeing the stories and the arguments that are there. So I don't know what the corrective is, Linda, but there has to be a corrective.
Yes. A growing body of psychological study seems to indicate that narrative is false, that by and large our actions are determined either by chance or by our unconscious minds, and that while we construct narrative for what has happened to us, we construct narrative for what we think will happen to us, in fact, that's not the way the world is. And I wondered if any of you could comment on whether or not you think that the narrative is dishonest, or is it honest? And if it's dishonest, is it appropriate as a rhetorical tool? All four of you can.
Perhaps there's something. I mean, I take it you're referring to some of the psychological literature about the unreliability of eyewitness testimony and accounts of the world and how cognition works in a variety of ways that trick us in what we think we see. I don't think those are necessary. Those insights, and they're much more developed than that. The cognitive bias, cognitive theory, all of that cognitive science literature, is in tension. I mean, it's in tension with narrative, but I don't think it's in contradiction with narrative. That because what it does is it gives us another perspective on what it is narrative is doing and the construction of people's realities, what they think they see, what they think they know, through various cognitive mechanisms is there to be interrogated in all those ways, and that there's something about those constructions, that narratives are constructions, that is helpful, not troubling. And I don't think truth is the best way to get at it, but to recognize that both are going on in ways and in interaction with each other in ways that we need to keep probing to understand what a client says about what happens, what a police officer says about what happens, what a judge is constructing in his or her mind about what happened. All of those cognitive processes are operating in various ways that narratives get constructed. So it becomes, I think, another tool for understanding how narrative works rather than an external perspective that says it's true or not.
I think that last point is a nice entry point. As Anne said earlier, this concept that there's one true story that students struggle with because they interview their client for the first time and they don't know what to do with this story that doesn't seem consistent with other things they think they know. It's an opportunity to talk about ethical limitations on narrative. Is there a difference between a consciously false narrative and one that may be simply one of several narratives that are out there? What I used to find very interesting to do and to talk to students about in a criminal clinic, when you would interview a defendant who had a story of exculpation. You know, I wasn't even in town. If I was in town, I wasn't on the corner. If I was in the corner, I didn't knife him. If I knifed him, I didn't kill, you know, all those things. Is to talk to the client. Sometimes you have that kind of interview, and then you're trying to figure out, okay, but what the other side's story is so completely different. I can't get from my client sort of the perspective on that. I need to talk to others. But we would talk to students about saying, well, why not ask the client, what do you think they'd say about what happened? What's their story? What's their narrative? And because of that distancing, it's not what I'm saying, it's what they're saying, you often get some very, very insightful views from your client about what their theory of the case is. Because whether it's because that's really the truth or just because, well, here, you know, because of their biases, here's what I think they would say. And it made it easier for clients to have, I think, information exchange with the lawyer that would be helpful beyond the, you know, they're lying, I'm telling the truth, don't you believe me kind of interaction. And I think it's both. It can be, you know, a useful heuristic. It also can open up someone to say, you know, now that I look at it from that other perspective, maybe I'm thinking a little bit different about this problem. And that may or may not change what you actually do. So I guess I'm not so worried about the, you know, the falseness or the contestedness of the narrative, because I think that we do it whether we own up to it or not. So it's our job to try to be as consistent with what all the information we have, both from the client and from the world, and present the best case we can for the client from that perspective. And I don't think, by the way, that that's inconsistent to decenter the story from the client to something else if that's a better strategy. I think talking to the client about that as a strategy makes it, in my mind, consistent with client-centeredness. I mean, sometimes, you know, you don't want the client to be the center of the story, because if the client's the center of the story, you lose. But if the outrageousness of the state behavior is the center of the story, you might win. Mm-hmm. So I think a client could understand why that might be an effective strategy in a particular case.
We have one more question over here.
I guess this is really for Phil. I mean, I think it is important to teach students how to construct a story, but I also think that you have to be careful about using techniques from fiction or from creative nonfiction in telling a legal story. For example, if you look at the Mailer passage that you looked at, the line, Gilmore said, no, he was trying to smile as he lay down on the floor. Gilmore said, put your arms under your body. Jensen got into a position with his hands under his stomach. He was still trying to smile. Well, I think those are telling, his trying to smile, I think, is telling details. But how did they get to know that? That's Mailer, I think, injecting himself into the scene, trying to envision how it worked. But that's, I don't know if a lawyer could have that kind of telling detail. And I think when you're teaching students to write statements of the case, you have to be, you have to give them techniques to teach it, but also when techniques of creative nonfiction go too far.
Of course, there's the cautionary note that you don't invent stories, but actually when you're dealing with a brief or a post-conviction relief case, there's plenty of material there to create the powerful images, and it will be there whether it's the psychological observations about the defendant or some amazing image about what happened in the crime. Those details will in fact be there, but it's the fear of the power of storytelling that sometimes deselects exactly what should be in the brief. So yes, of course you're right, you don't fabricate or invent. But on the other hand, you have to know how to use the images. And one of the most powerful things in any storytelling is the use of images to evoke a scene in the imagination of the reader. And if you can't do that in many types of practice, you're in big trouble.
Okay, that wraps up our panel. We're going to move into lunch, but I just want to take a second to thank our great panelists.